So today, I want to talk about the balance of metta. This is a strange time on the retreat. We're in the flow, the metta can be quite strong, and then suddenly thoughts intrude about the future, and we get carried away for a while. But then we reincline to the metta, and boom, we're back again. For many of us, the continuity we might have had a couple of days ago is not as obvious. The mind is leaping ahead into the future. It's not always an easy time of the retreat. Even though there's momentum, there's also the pull of the future. One person mentioned yesterday fighting with nature. You know, it just felt like a real struggle. And at this point in the retreat, it can be very helpful to recollect equanimity. So that's why I want to talk about the balance of metta. Because to a large extent, the maturing of the practice is really about the development and strengthening of balance. Balance in the face of nature, in the face of the way things are, in the face of the way we are right now. And when we understand the simplicity of that, it can clear up a lot of confusion. The kind of thing when we think, well, what do I do now? Well, just be with whatever is happening. Radiate metta anyway, with as much grace as you can find. I actually don't have to say anything more than this. I could say, okay, talk is done, 5 minutes. But I'll go on. And as important as balance is, as equanimity is, it's also a little difficult to speak about because it's not one state, but many. There's a wide range and scope of what we call equanimity. In the context of the metta practice, Ariya spoke the other day of it as a brahmavihara. But as you undoubtedly know, it's all over in the texts, woven through the texts. Whether the Buddha is speaking about metta or vipassana or just plain life, and I want to speak today about how we can use it now, that inclination to that, at this point in the retreat. And later, as we take the metta out into the world. So to back up a little and speak of definitions, because it helps to know what we're talking about. In general, the English word equanimity that we use. In Pali, there are two different words that get translated this way. The most common one is upeka, this word you know very well from the chants. And it has a basic meaning of to look over. And it refers to the ability to observe something without being caught in it. The commentaries talk about upeka as to see with patience or seeing with understanding. And this plays out, you very well know it in your regular life. I really like that holding of it because everybody knows the experience of perhaps somebody says something harsh to us. And we realize, oh, they've just had a bad day. It's nothing to do with me. Seeing with patience, seeing with understanding. We don't spin out on that harsh word and get caught in stories about what it might mean. This form of equanimity is often compared in the text to grandmotherly love. And I really like that. Many of you, I guess, or some of you would have grandchildren. I don't have any kids, so I can't relate to this viscerally, but I can only imagine. You know, your grandkids, they're precious, but they're not your business to discipline much. And grandmothers clearly love their grandkids, but thanks to her experience with her own kids, is less likely to be caught up in the dramas of their lives. You've done it already. It's not that big a deal. So upeka, and there are many forms of this. In the Visuddhimagga, there are 10 forms of equanimity listed. And I'll speak more in terms of metta, or equanimity in a metta context a little later. The second Pali word that's used for equanimity is tatramaja tata. Thus, in the middleness is how it's translated. Being in the middle of everything. They're in the middle of all this. And this refers to a profound kind of equanimity, of being in the middle of samsara and not being moved. Unshakable balance in the face of whatever is happening, whatever sense contact is happening, whatever experience is happening. And this is particularly important in the context of vipassana. But in the metta practice, we experience this, a shadow of this, when we can radiate metta to our enemies and still feel metta, still feel that flow of friendly well-wishing. And we're not pulled by the stories of what they might have done, how they might have harmed us. So upeka, tatramaja tata, the 10 kinds of upeka. I don't want to go into detail about that, just to give you a background, a context, because this is a many-layered word, or equanimity, with that range of meanings and manifestations. And particularly as pertains to the cultivation of metta, to metta bhavana, what we need to remember about equanimity is that it always carries the flavor of balance, of impartiality, that boundlessness of metta that doesn't prefer one being over any other beings. That impartiality that happens when the barriers in the heart have broken down. It's that kind presence that doesn't get entranced by reactions that might be habitual of liking and not liking. Just as metta has a near and far enemy, of course, so does upeka. The near enemy is disconnection. And we all know this from our own experience. It's that kind of experience when, you know, something happens that shakes you. And, you know, the wall comes down, the armor comes on, and we say, oh, well, I'm okay with that. You know, almost as a reflex. We've pushed it away. That kind of disconnection can seem like balance, can seem like equanimity, but it's not. It's disconnected. It's avoidance. And the far enemy is attachment or aversion. Upekkha is the mind at rest. And it always has the flavor of contentment and composure. There's a stillness to it. And this is why, as the metta practice goes on and the metta becomes stronger and more powerful, the metta becomes cooler. You know, as we begin the metta practice and we work with a dear friend, it can be very buoyant and happy and light and, you know, full of flow of love. And then that settles down into this stillness. That's the balance of pure metta. That's the equanimity. And at first, because we're not used to it, we don't like it half the time. You know, I'm not sure I want this, I want love, you know, and we think of love as something quite warm and flowing and happy and joyful and all of that, blissful. But as most of you know by now, the coolness of metta, the coolness of pure metta, is very still, very balanced, very composed, just well-wishing, without any sentimental attachment. And I really like that word composure. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha speaks about composure and contentment like this. He says, bhikkhus, possessed of five things, a bhikkhu is able to live engaging in proper composure. What five? Here, a bhikkhu is tolerant of forms, tolerant of sounds, tolerant of odors, tolerant of tastes, tolerant of physical sensations. Possessed with these five things, a bhikkhu is able to live engaging in proper composure. So, composure and contentment don't mean we disconnect when negative things happen, but we're able to just let them be with patience. And that patience is really a big part of the development of equanimity. There's tolerance. We don't, you know, try to fix or change. So composure and contentment have a lot in common with that acceptance and embracing what is that we talk about a lot in the metta practice. This is a form of metta. And this tolerance, this composure, always comes with connection. It's not that near enemy of disconnection or disengagement. Nor is it any form of just, you know, grit your teeth and endure it. And it's not the pretend equanimity of spiritual bypassing. That tendency, actually, most of us have at some point or another to use spiritual ideas and practices to avoid actually facing things that are unresolved. So it's not that, oh, it's just all impermanent, or it's not me. It's not that at all. It's we really connect with that experience without pushing it away, but there is that composure, that stability of mind, that balance. So here on retreat, we begin to see it, even when the metta is not, the momentum is not stable, when the metta is patchy. This kind of composure is what allows us to hold whatever is arising anyway, really kindly. We might be shaken by it, we might not like it, we might be quite reactive, but we can hold that whole thing with kindness. That's actually the beginnings of deeper equanimity. Even though we're strongly in the flow of some reaction or another, there is a little bit of space that says, oh, well, may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. And space is a funny thing. You know, space from some difficult experience that we might otherwise get caught in. We tend to think that we need to have a kilometer between us and it. You know, we need to have a lot of space so that it can just play out and we're not really caught there. But it doesn't always look like that. Sometimes it's just a millimeter. But space is space. A millimeter of space is as good as a kilometer. So please don't take that millimeter of space and dismiss it as unimportant. This is the development of that balance. It's actually incredibly important. And it's that space, that little millimeter of acceptance that matures into something much bigger and broader and more stable. And when that balance of metta becomes strong, there is really a palpable sense of this boundlessness that the chants we do every evening speak about. The balance that arises with pure metta when it doesn't distinguish between ourself, the friend, the enemy, all beings. And in the last days, a number of people have spoken so beautifully of their practice. It's been very touching to hear your experiences of this. Experiences of metta that's deepened to the point where there's no distinguishing of self and other as far as the metta is concerned. And the metta just goes to whomever, whatever beings it's directed towards, regardless. People have also spoke of losing a sense of singularity, a sense of I am here radiating metta to them out there. So that it's not that I'm radiating metta to you, but there's no felt difference, no sense of separation. There's no longer me at the center with the metta going out. It's just that we're all in this field of metta together. Someone said, quite touchingly, they said, I really can't believe it. That there can be this metta for my worst enemy. But these experiences are a normal expression of the boundlessness of metta. The impartiality, the lack of ill will or craving, or fear or anger, but just kindness and care that comes naturally, without effort, even to enemies, even to evil beings. Another person yesterday put it this way. They said, the metta has become the ground of being, and there's no one outside of that. I was so touched by that, because it really beautifully expresses this balance of pure metta. And in this context, I want to go back to the very beginning to remind you of what metta is. Because it's a very helpful touchstone to remember this both here and in the world as a guide to say, is this balance there or is it not? The Abhidhamma definition of this state that we call metta is that it has the characteristic of the mode or manner of friendliness, its basic friendliness. And it functions to promote that. So its function is promoting friendliness. It manifests as the disappearance of ill will. So when metta is present, ill will is absent. Its proximate cause or its footing is seeing with kindness. It succeeds when ill will is eliminated, and it fails when it degenerates into selfish, affectionate desire. So that's the textbook definition of metta. And it has embedded in it, as you can hear, all through it, this balance. No ill will. No affectionate, selfish desire. Resting in the middle. And here on retreat, when we experience this, particularly as it, pertains to enemies and difficult people, it can be a life-changing experience. It can be a real eye-opener. As that person said, I can't believe it. Because when there's that palpable friendliness and that lack of ill will to everyone, regardless of our petty preferences, when we see how we can unhook from tendencies of fault-finding and see the good side of that person who has annoyed or even harmed us, and when we see how metta can well up by itself like water coming out of a spring, this changes our view of our own potential, changes our view of our own nature. And we realize, oh, this is possible for me as well. Even if it's not stable. Because as you well know, it's not always that way. It's not always easy. And when we're confronted by life, when we're confronted by the way things are, we encounter all our inner edges. Where we feel challenged, where we lose that balance, where we lose that composure, And we've spoken about this a lot in the context of purification. This is the place of practice. Because fortunately, those edges, those places where we lose that balance, are not fixed. You know, the buzzword now in, you know, neurological circles is neuroplasticity. It's a big word saying you can change. We might have ideas about how we are and what we'll never be able to do, but don't forget those moments when something happened here that was really difficult. And you kept inclining to metta, and everything changed. In both practice and in life, when we hit something kind of intractable, or one of those edges that's stubbornly persistent, rather than assuming that's the way it will always be, and that there's nothing to be done, please remember, it has not always been this way for you. And it's not black and white. It's not as if you have balance all the time or not all the time. It's just that accessing this balance of metta is a matter of skill. It's something we develop and train in. Of course, that's what you've been doing here all this time. Day after day after day. Well, happy, peaceful. Well, happy, peaceful. Inclining the mind in that direction. And you see, as Saito said, you see the results. And of course, many of you are probably asking yourselves or have asked us, but what about out there? The first thing to say is what I just said, really, is when those experiences happen here, don't forget them. Remember that you can do this. Remember that you have the capacity to do this. Even if it's only just once. I think it was Ariya who quoted one of the texts that said, you know, one moment of metta is more valuable than, you know, the offering of 100 pots of rice. There's a power to a single moment of metta, if you remember it. So when things go out of balance, you remember, oh, I accessed this once before. This is not fixed. So don't think it would be completely impossible for you to access this flow of metta in quote-unquote real life, where things are much more difficult and complicated and fast. Maybe we can't do it now. But as the Buddha said, if it were impossible, I would not ask you to do it. It's not impossible. The Buddha did it. He was a human being, not a god. And we all have role models in this life. People we've seen or read about, they've done it. And if they can do it, we can do it. And if you can access it here, you can access it out there. Just a matter of patience. And here's where we need equanimity, that form of equanimity that manifests as patience, tolerance. not to be impatient with the speed of our path. We have to start small, that's all, and recognize the balance of metta when it is there, just like practice here, and go on from there. You know, when you radiate metta to other beings, as we've all said, you look at the good side. And that's what allows the heart to open with metta. And it's the same in the bigger picture when you look at your practice. Please don't fixate on what's difficult, on where you're not free. If you want to fixate on something, fixate on what you can do. Not with ego or pride, but just as a way of cultivating a balanced attitude. We can judge ourselves so harshly. Oh, I've done that. I've sat all month and nothing's happened. Well, huh. We don't know. So, taking the metta out there requires this patience and requires enough equanimity towards ourselves, towards what's going on, to protect the heart when things get interesting. To be able to retain some connection with compassion and loving kindness for ourselves and others, while keeping your boundaries. This is a basic life skill. And when we come to practice here, it is in some ways artificial. We've provided this container of silence and solitude with a schedule, you know, with all the little things that make a retreat a retreat. And these constraints are supportive of the deepening, continuity of cultivation of metta, so that we can just do the practice and, you know, deal with what comes up without interruption. In the service of training the mind, of purifying it, in the service of having the metta arise. And, of course, out there, no one is expecting that these conditions hold. They don't. It's different out there. So think of your time here as like going to the gym, doing very specific exercises, perhaps with machines, perhaps with a climbing wall, to train the body, to train the mind. And just as the point of going to the gym is not being a perfect gym rat, the point of coming here is not to be the perfect yogi. The point is to take it out into the world and use it. So you use the climbing wall, you use the machines to build the body, to train the body, to train the mind, so that you can climb the Matterhorn or whatever, Everest. You go climb the mountain, and that's the fruit of all that training in the gym. Likewise, you've done all this training here, not to be a perfect yogi, because just being here is good enough. But what about out there? This gives us the tools and the strength of heart and mind and the strength of balance to navigate our lives out there in a different way. And I often like to think that the retreat really begins when you start talking, and then when you go out the gate and live your lives. That's also part of the retreat. It's a test of the practice. It's a reality check. Just as on retreat, the daily activities are a reality check, this takes that into a bigger place, into the place of the world, and we see. And as I said in my last talk, we all tend to assess our practice based on all sorts of things, but particularly based on things we experience on our cushions or in the walking, our experiences of metta or our experiences of concentration. But how well the retreat really went will become clear in the next weeks, months, years. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. And it's so important that you keep doing this out there, because there's an absolute need for more metta in the world right now. So when you go out, as Saito says, don't leave it at the gate, just as you don't leave it here in the Dhamma hall. And we know this intellectually, but as soon as we get into the grooves of our daily life habits, it's harder to remember. It's harder to incline to kindness. But remember metta in deed, speech, and thought, and take that as your everyday practice out in the world. Starting with sila, which I spoke about already, and I know Aria will speak a bit more about tomorrow. And then just to get creative. This is such a fluid practice. And there aren't very many ways of getting it wrong, so long as you're inclining to well-wishing. And there are countless ways in life to cultivate kindness. And if you make it a game, you can't fail, both in big and small ways. I was just reading the other day about something that I found very touching. There are groups of people who meet together to write cards, handwritten cards that say, you know, kind things. You know, and then they go, they might meet in a bookstore, and they write these cards, and they hide them for people to find. That's a very creative way of cultivating metta. You can do all sorts of things like that. Or maybe you're buying your morning coffee. If you have some loose change, you can pay for the person behind you. You know, there's so many ways of cultivating metta in action, in speech. And when metta becomes natural, not only is it a joy, but it brings, you know, an internal joy, but it brings collective harmony. It brings peace. It brings that balance of metta into the community. And it makes a difference in the lives we lead. It makes a difference for everybody around us. Because when there is this habit of metta, when there is this balance, and we live that, it's inevitable that it will have results outside too. From the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Fives, the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, there are these five means of dwelling at ease. What five? Here, a bhikkhu maintains bodily acts of loving kindness towards his fellow monks, both openly and privately. He maintains verbal acts of loving kindness towards his fellow monks, both openly and privately. He maintains mental acts of loving kindness towards his fellow monks, both openly and privately. He dwells both openly and privately, possessing in common with his fellow monks virtuous behavior that is unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, leading to concentration. He dwells both openly and privately, possessing in common with his fellow monks the view that is noble and emancipating, which leads one who acts upon it to the complete destruction of suffering. Those bhikkhus are the five means of dwelling at ease. I find this very moving. The first three, of course, are metta, indeed, speech, and thought. Openly and privately. And that points to that place in the Metta Sutta where the Buddha says that we need to be straight, very straight. That we need to have this harmony between how we act outwardly and how we are inwardly. To be straight, not to be hypocritical. And the fourth of these five is sila, conduct, which, as you know, is itself metta in action. And only the fifth falls outside the realm of cultivating metta. But really, as metta bhavana is a strong support for vipassana insight, there is an indirect application of that too. So we dwell together openly and privately with metta indeed, speech and thought. And this leads to ease, this leads to harmony. This leads to, as one monk described to the Buddha, dwelling together like milk and water. But, and, then there's the high bar, isn't there, out there, when life goes into seriously difficult territory. The places where we find, or we think, it's impossible to cultivate metta in any way. All beings includes the worst amongst us, and it includes the worst of ourself. These people we hate, these people we think, I'll never get along with them, we can never get along with them, it's impossible. Want to bet? It's true. It's possible. And the Buddha was absolutely he was really in your face about this. Let's put it that way. His instruction about dealing with these situations and these people, and you know it very well from having chanted it almost every night, Metta sahagatena chetasa, like that. I will abide, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second, third, fourth, above, below, and all around. No matter what. This is his instruction to us. And it's an uncompromising instruction that really forces us to face where we don't want to open. Because often that place of we'll never get along, it's impossible, is I don't even want to try. And we all feel this sometimes. In the Majjhima Nikaya, there's a sutta called the Assembly of the Saw. And the Buddha says, there are five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or connected with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or spoken with inner hate. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind of loving kindness. And you know the rest, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And he goes on to say, it's not just words, but this is the part, when I first read it, I kind of went, oh. He says, even if bandits were to sever you limb from limb with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hatred toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. And he goes on again to say the same thing. But this is not a commandment. He doesn't say, you will do this. He says, you will train thus, which acknowledges that maybe we can't do it yet, but this is our training to find that place of balance, that place of equanimity, that place of composure, that place of ease, resting in the middle of all that, where we can actually access kindness. So this is not an instruction to blow off by rolling your eyes inwardly and going, oh yeah, right, forget it. I mean, that was my first response, I have to say. It's like, oh, impossible. Well, I can't say I can do it yet. But I do see that this is where the practice goes. So it's just a matter of patience and plodding onwards to keep going. The Buddha had to deal with, and he wasn't speaking of from a place of not knowing about this stuff. The Buddha dealt with all sorts of harsh words directed towards him from all sorts of people, from kings to Brahmins. He dealt with assassins. He dealt with his cousin who was constantly trying to kill him and almost succeeding. And we might say, well, it's just the Buddha. You know, those are stories. And that's just a way of dismissing our own potential. Closer to home, there are people in this world now who do this same thing. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says this. He says, genuine compassion means we treat everyone the same. We develop understanding and warm-heartedness even to our enemies. And you might think, well, okay, that's the Dalai Lama. Or somebody like Desmond Tutu says similar things. But it's not just the Buddha or the Dalai Lama or Desmond Tutu. It's common people. And if you go online and Google, you know, forgiveness stories or kindness stories, there are so many examples of this. And often when this happens, this person has an epiphany. Maybe there are a number of examples of people whose, maybe their child has been murdered by somebody. And they start hating this person, of course, you know, really feeling deep, profound anger. But then there's an epiphany and they realize, well, if I keep hating this person, I'm in prison. What happened, happened. There's no undoing that. So I have a choice. I either hate them or love them. And that's a moment of freedom. One such person that I find so touching is she's an American psychologist. Originally, she was from Hungary. And she wrote a book called The Choice. And it's basically a story of her life, how she came to understanding this basic fact. When she was 16, her whole family was deported to a concentration camp. And she was fortunate. At least she and her sister survived. And that was just the backdrop of the book, because it's her story of coming to kindness, to understanding that she has a choice, we all have a choice, on how we respond to what people do to us and what people say about us. She says, we had no control over the most consuming facts of our lives. But we have the power to determine how we experience life after that, after trauma. Survivors can continue to be victims long after the oppression has ended, or they could learn to thrive. We can choose to be our own jailers, or we can choose to be free. We imprison ourselves with our resentment and our grudges and our stories of hatred, no matter how rational they might seem. And we have a choice to move on after something has happened, no matter how difficult. We have a choice to radiate loving kindness. This is a terrible, terribly difficult choice to make, but we can do this. So we as people have our work cut out for us. But always to remember the potential that you've tapped into here. Somebody said yesterday, this metta is not a goal we strive for, but a place where we can rest in what we really are. Exactly. We tap into that. And And one moment of pure metta here can tap us into a lifetime of cultivating it out there. And ultimately becoming that person that the Buddha was speaking of in the Metta Sutta. One who is skilled in goodness and knows the path of peace. Finding that balance again and again and again is what does that. So for now, please just continue. As Saito said yesterday, we have good conditions here for practice. And that's never guaranteed. And the more you practice here, no matter how it goes, the more you're strengthening that capacity to access the beautiful balance of metta. So thank you for your kind attention. Thank you for your continued practice. And may this practice lead you inexorably and quickly to that beautiful place of absolutely unshakable heart, that freedom of mind. Thank you, everybody, for your practice, and thank you for your kind attention. So, instructions. Those of you who have been here for the month, please continue exactly as you've been going. Radiating metta to all beings here in the center and all beings in the world. And those of you who have come for the second half, the second metta retreat, I almost think the drums should be playing right now. Now is the time to change the category. You've been strengthening your metta these days with this neutral person, these neutral people, again and again and again. And, of course, before that, with the other categories. Now it's time to change to what the texts call the enemy. Please don't start with your worst enemy. The other way of putting this is the difficult person. If you start simply and easily with somebody you just find mildly annoying. There's something about the way they walk, or the way they eat, something, you know, someone in your life that you just, you know, you see them and you go, oh, I wish they wouldn't do that. Let it be some mild annoyance. Don't, as I say, start with your worst enemy or somebody you have an agenda about fixing your relationship with them because it's really bad. And actually, I wouldn't suggest starting with a neighbor you're having difficulty with, like at home. Because neighbors, this can be a very poisonous relationship if it's difficult. Start, as I said, start simply, start easily with somebody you find annoying or that you dislike. Radiating metta to that person in the same way as you've done with all the other beings, all the other people. If the metta begins to flow strongly and powerfully to that person, you can change to somebody a little more difficult. But in this first day, please do not I beg you, go to that person that you really want to fix your relationship with. Go to that person who has really harmed you in the deepest possible way. You can do that later. Start where it's easy. And in the sitting meditation, radiate metta for this person. In the walking meditation and around the forest path, continue to cultivate metta for all beings. Allowing that to balance what might be a bit of intensity with the difficult person. Yeah, thank you, everybody. And an announcement or a question. We are very aware that it's beginning to heat up. This hall is beginning to get quite warm, in the afternoon particularly. There has been a request from some people in the back, is it possible to open the windows during the daytime? So between, say, 8 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, opening the windows in the back so that it can be a little cooler in here. If anybody has any objections to that, yeah. The side windows, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe not to open them all the way, but just a little bit, so that there is some breeze, but not a draft. And that way we can all be comfortable in here. And then please do close them all back there after 5 o'clock. So anybody, whoever is the last person to leave the hall before juice time, if you're in the back, to please close the back windows and not open them again until after the working period in here, so that those who tend to be chilly and cold can have some refuge.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.